From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're joined by fiddle and guitar icons and musical archaeologists Jay Unger and Molly Mason. Surely recognize the melody, even if you don't know the name of it, but that is Ashokan Farewell, performed by our guests tonight, Jay Unger and Molly Mason. It's only a sampling of the song that put our guests on the musical map when it was featured on the Ken Burns documentary series, The Civil War. But later in the hour, we promise we will play the song in its entirety. Ashokan Farewell, as you may know, took Jay Unger and Molly Mason out of the coffee houses and contra dances and into the eyes and ear of America, winning them a Grammy and nominating them for an Emmy. Performing together now for 25 years, the husband and wife team of Jay Unger and Molly Mason has had a mission of unearthing American musical gems like Appalachian waltzes, New England contra songs, Cajun dip and slides, even Celtic music. All traditional and popular music of their day to their listeners. Ironic, too, that this team of traditional music preservers are not themselves from Appalachia or the rural South, but from the Bronx and Washington State. Tonight on Point, we're wandering the trail of traditional American dance music, from the Civil War to the golden age of country and swing, plus Ashokan Farewell in its entirety, with the dynamic duo of Americana, fiddler Jay Unger and guitarist Molly Mason. Welcome to both of you to On Point.
Hello, Gail.
Hi, thank you.
Well, it's so great to have you with us, and I find it so interesting in reading articles about the two of you how much writers love to say that you play hits from the 60s, and then there's this pause, the 1860s.
Right, that's true. I remember a lot of other hits from the 60s, but we don't do those ones.
So what are the ones that you do?
Well, we have a nice little medley of what were the most popular tunes from the Civil War era, the ones that really got people going and gave them the courage to go on. We'd like to play that for you. These are tunes that were known north and south. If it was a southern tune, the northerners had their own lyrics. If it was a northern tune, the southerners had their lyrics. Parodies were really rampant during that era. But there was the melodies really united people in a special way. We'll give it a try here. These are five of those great old melodies. Thank you.
What a great sampling. Thank you both so much. Let's talk for a moment about the music of the 1860s, because as you know, there's been a resurgence of interest in this country in country traditional bluegrass music, and it's often commented that one of the reasons for that is that we long to return to more simple times. But I wonder if that's the whole story, Jay.
I don't think so. It is maybe part of it. People imagine them to be simple times, but the Civil War was anything but simple, and the times that followed it were quite complex as well. But I think what people are longing for is reality. You know, we're so hooked together by media and even email. We have great connections with a lot of people, but not so many face-to-face. And in those days, without electronic media, people sang together, they played music together. Family gatherings were never without live music, and by everyone who was sitting there. And this music, bluegrass, music of the 1860s, traditional American music, it's very accessible. People can learn to do it, and it feels like something that comes from where we come from, something that binds us together. And, you know, our camps at Ashokan in the summer, that's what they're all about, is giving the music back to the people. So they can listen to records if they want to, but they can also just sit around and have a good time jamming.
Exactly, and that's how people entertained each other in the days before there was radio and television.
Yeah, and with the amazing amount of folks, you know, purchasing instruments and hopefully not just hanging them on their walls, it's happening again.
So much of the music of that time was the sort of rousing battle cry of freedom kind of song of let's all go marching off to war. And on the other hand, there were these very deeply felt, intensely personal ballads like Lorena that reflected the other side of war. You know, not the grand and glorious part of marching off to battle, but the personal costs that came from that, losing sweethearts, fathers, brothers, loved ones. And even a song like Battle Cry of Freedom, which can be a rousing march tune, or if you play it very slowly, it becomes also a very melancholy and wistful sound.
It definitely does.
When we worked on the Civil War series for Ken Burns, one of the tunes that we played in, you know, both moods was Marching Through Georgia, which was written to commemorate Sherman's march, which was devastating to the South and really brought about the beginning of the end of the war. You know, it is a triumphant march, but when the scenes of the burning of Atlanta were being shown, we were playing it as a lament.
Can you give us a little of both?
Sure.
I think Molly will wander over to the piano for this.
While she's doing that, we should probably mention that both of you play not just fiddle. What else?
Ah, well, Molly was playing the mandolin earlier and the guitar, and she's moving over to the piano. I may play some mandolin in this set. We both dabble with a little banjo and various other stringed instruments. Okay, here we'll try Marching Through Georgia.
A song that to this day still makes some Georgians' hair stand on end.
Yeah, we've noticed that when we've played down there.
But you really can see the pictures of the flames over Atlanta when you play it in that very contemplative way.
It is a tragic scene,
yes,
for sure.
As you were doing the music for the Civil War series, was Ken talking you through these scenes? I mean, what kind of direction did you get?
It was really interesting. That's exactly what he was doing. He sat in a chair in the room where all the musicians were recording, and he would sort of give us a little description of what was going on in the Civil War at that time. He'd say, oh, you know, so-and-so just went to battle here, and they had so many people killed, and it was raining that night, and then he would have us do our tune. He'd also tell us, I think I want the song a little slow, or sometimes I'd want it very peppy. So he would give us that description too, but he would always tell us the stories of what was going on at this time, which was very helpful.
So that you could connect to the emotion of it as well.
His approach is with music is, you know, nearly 100% emotion. And that's why music that he uses works so well. He's got great radar for when you capture the right moment, the right emotion.
He has also great radar for tunes. You know,
he does.
He'll hear a tune and he'll say, oh, I know that one is going to be really good for this part. Yeah.
Well, we'll be back with more of Jay Unger and Molly Mason after we take a short break. Let's go into it listening to Cotton Patch Rag. That's a song of theirs with Swingology from their latest CD, Relax Your Mind. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the fiddle, guitar, and more duo and traditional American dance music preservers Jay Unger and Molly Mason. Here they are performing That River's Taking Care of Me, another song that's featured on their latest CD, Relax Your Mind.
One, two, three, four. He gives me everything I need, and I love that river. That river's taking care of me. I catch my breakfast, I catch my supper. He gives me everything free. So I love that river. That river's taking care of me. Stops to ask me the reason I'm here. He just fills my empty bottle. All that he's got, he's willing to share. So I guess that river has a soul. When I've got troubles, well, he takes my troubles and he carries them out to the sea. So I love that river. That river's taken care of me. Care of me. Yes, I love that river. That river's taken care of me.
Well, folks, if that doesn't get you into a mellow Friday mood, I don't know what's going to. That's great. You know, earlier in the program, we referred to the fact that you folks, Jay, are from the Bronx, and you, Molly, are from Washington State. So, Jay, you first. How did a nice boy from the Bronx wind up hooking into this music?
Yeah, that is interesting. How did I? Well, in the 1950s, I was born in the 40s, so in the 50s or so, I wound up hearing recordings of bluegrass and old-time music, which were very hard to find in the Bronx, I must say, at that time. And when I got to high school, around 1960 or so, I ran into more of this sort of thing, and friends were trading reel-to-reel tapes of this esoteric, hard-to-find music. And I was already playing violin, classical music, and I like to play by ear, so I started picking this stuff up and playing with friends who had banjos and guitars. And it was kind of the folk boom of the 60s that got me going. And then I made some trips to Tennessee and North Carolina, even in my late teens, to try to play with some traditional players down there and go to some of the festivals. It bit me bad.
Clearly.
I never stopped.
And how about you, Molly?
Well, my dad and his family played music when they were kids. And so when I grew up, my dad played mandolin and his brother played fiddle. They would get together and play occasionally. So I kind of grew up listening to old fiddle tunes and things that people played in the 20s and 30s. And my brother, James Mason, who's a great fiddle player too, started playing when he was 10 years old. I started playing guitar when I was 11, and I just always loved it. And then when I got into college, I found all these other wonderful types of music, some swing things and Django Reinhardt and bluegrass music also from people who lived where I went to school and were wonderful musicians.
And you used to play in some competitions, if I recall correctly.
I did used to go to some fiddle contests with my brother, who is 5 years younger than me, and would go and play. And that was a lot of fun, just meeting all these other wonderful fiddlers and guitar players. I got some great information about how to play the guitar better at those.
I think for both of us and for anybody doing this stuff today, that going to festivals and contests, you get... The best part of it is the parking lot picking, campground picking.
Meeting new people and playing tunes.
And just playing, till dawn with people you enjoy.
And how did the two of you get together?
We met at a music club here in New York State called the Town Crier Cafe.
I was visiting the East Coast for the first time, and a friend of mine said, "Hey, you got to go to this wonderful place and hear music tonight." So I did.
And you played.
And I did
actually.
Play.
Got up and played with Susie Rothfield.
Right, a friend of mine who was singing there. Mm-hmm.
And I bet that got your attention, Jay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we're all delighted that you two did get together. Give us a little sense of how the fiddle styles of traditional America really vary. What you hear in New England is not necessarily what you're going to hear down south, and what you hear in the French Canadian provinces is not what you're going to hear
in Washington State.
New Orleans and Washington State, exactly.
We can do a little fiddling travelogue. When we started the camps at Ashokan, the Ashokan Fiddle and Dance Workshops in 1980, the first year or two, the camp was a mixture of all those styles. And then it's almost like the Civil War occurred, and the people who played Northern music wound up at one end of the camp, and the people who played Southern music wound up at the other end for the jam sessions. So then the next year we created Northern Week and Southern Week. So I think maybe we'll play, let's play a tune that you'd hear at Northern Week that might be played for contra dancing. And let's play a couple of jigs. Let's do, we'll do the Rose and the Heather. And that Scottish one, The Stool of Repentance.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Joy of My Life, we'll start with, so you can pick it on the guitar. We'll do once through each.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, if we had everyone all mellow a few minutes ago, I think now they're probably up dancing around the room or perhaps just snapping their fingers in the car.
Well, that's good. You have to you have to change off, you know.
They come from, like, Scottish and Irish tradition and their jigs, and they're not part of the Southern tradition at all. But in New England, people love to play that stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
And maybe we'll try a Southern tune. See, and also we change keys and play different tunes in a medley, very common at a contra dance.
I was going to say, what stylistically is the difference between the Northern version and the Southern version?
In the Southern music, there's a little more of a kind of laid-back, even if it's fast, kind of a swinginess and more a little more bluesiness, and the groove is a little more on the backbeat or the offbeat.
Mm-hmm.
Let's try something with the guitar.
Okay.
And people will tend to play one tune for a long time in a hypnotic sort of way, and for square dancing more than... for Southern style.
It must just be
dancing.
All that hot weather, I think.
I don't know what it is. Let's try that old tune, Sailing Ladies.
Want to play yourself once?
Yeah, pick it along with me. You play some melody with me.
Okay.
Of these songs conjure up such great pictures in your head of people dancing and just enjoying them. I'm wondering, you mentioned the influence of the weather. What other influences came to bear here in terms of what people were listening to and playing and singing in the North versus the South? Is it geography alone? Is it religion? You know, what else was happening there?
Well, clearly, you know, the larger population of Black Americans in the South had an influence as far as the blues elements. And a lot of the fiddling was done by Black people in the 1700s and 1800s. And they learned to play music, in many cases, for themselves and their own amusement, but also for white patrons or people who owned them. And the music developed with that whole side of things a great deal more in the South. I mean, people like... Bob Wills from Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, and Bill Monroe of Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys, two very well-known icons, one of Western swing, the other of bluegrass, attribute Black musicians, specific ones, as some of their early influences and important ones. And that doesn't happen so much in New England, where you know, it's mostly was white people, and it was mostly Irish, Scottish, English backgrounds, some Scandinavian maybe. So that's part of it, I would say, why the music sounds differently. And the dance styles are very different, too.
Mm-hmm.
And all fiddle music is essentially dance music. And the dancing in the South is it's more of a backbeat sort of feel to it.
We are, as promised, going to let people hear a longer version of Ashokan Farewell. But before we do that, this is not a song that was written specifically for the Ken Burns Civil War series. Where did it come from and how did it get to him?
Yeah, okay. Well, I mentioned our camps at Ashokan. That's in the Catskill Mountains, and started them in 1980. And at the end of the third year, 1982, the feeling of community that had happened that summer at the camp was so strong that when I got home, I was feeling a sense of loss and longing that was very deep, you know, wanting to be back with my friends in that idyllic, almost utopia sort of setting. And I picked up the fiddle and tried to express that and just find my way back to some form of sanity, let's call it. And that tune emerged. And it made me cry quite a bit at first. And I put a tape recorder on so I could keep the tune, not lose it. I didn't want to stop playing and try to write it down. Eventually, we recorded it with our band Fiddle Fever on a recording that came out in 84. And Matt Glazer and Russ Barenberg, two of the band members, were working with Ken on one of his early films, The Brooklyn Bridge. And they gave him a copy. And when he heard it, that tune in particular stuck with him. And he contacted us very early on to start working on some of his other films and eventually The Civil War.
And he even says that while he has heard it at least 2,000 times, and I can believe it because the editing process is very long on something like this, it still brings tears to his eyes. And I think that's true of a lot of us.
Yeah, many people are affected by it in that way. And I get a lot of letters from folks who have remarkable personal stories about it. Yeah, it's just amazed me over the years. And I enjoy playing it for people because I do realize that there are many people who just have deep feelings about it, and it's a joy to be able to give that to them.
Well, we'll be back with much more music from Jay Unger and Molly Mason, but let's go into this break listening to that full version of Ashokan Farewell, as promised. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking this hour with Jay Unger and Molly Mason, who bring to their listeners and fans American musical gems of traditional dance music from the Civil War right through to the golden age of country and swing. Here they are performing another song from their new CD, Relax Your Mind, with Swingology. This one's called Homegrown Tomatoes.
There's nothing in the world that I like better than making me a sandwich with a homegrown tomato. I'm up in the morning and out in the garden. I pick me a ripe one, don't pick a hard one. You plant them in the spring and eat them all summer. Wintertime without them is a culinary bummer. Forget all about the sweating and the digging. Each time you go out and pick you a big one. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be without homegrown tomatoes? There's only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. When you're feeling droopy, one thing's for sure, there's nothing that a homegrown tomato can't cure. Put them in a salad or put them in a stew, where you can make your own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs or eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, both pinto or navy. Serve them on the side or serve them in the middle. Put your homegrown tomatoes on a hot cake griddle. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be without homegrown tomatoes? There's only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Well, if I could change this life I lead, I'd be Johnny Tomato Seed, 'cause I know what this country needs, and it's homegrown tomatoes in every yard you see. So when I die, don't you bury me in a crop in a cemetery. Out in the garden would be much better, so I can be pushing up homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be without homegrown tomatoes? There's only two things that money can buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be without homegrown tomatoes? There's only two things that money can buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
And by that, you mean homegrown tomatoes that taste like tomatoes and not those little round things you get from the supermarket that taste like rocks, right?
The real thing, the real thing.
That song comes from Guy Clark.
Yes, an interesting way. I learned it from a friend of mine who had heard it from a Guy Clark record, and she just sang it to me with no accompaniment. She wanted me to accompany her. So I tried to figure out how it went, the way she sang it, and this is what I got. And about, 6 years later, I heard Guy Clark's version of it, and it's completely different, different chords, you know. The words are the same. The melody is pretty much the same, but his chording is very different. So
we've taken it somewhere.
Guy Clark, I did a new version of your tune. I hope you don't mind, but at least I did record it.
And we do love homegrown tomatoes. We grow them every year.
Yeah.
I wonder where the two of you see yourselves in this kind of long line of American traditional musicians. Do you see yourselves as passing on the baton, keeping it alive certainly in your lifetimes, and then also passing the baton to a new generation of musicians?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, the camps at Ashokan, we definitely have people in their teens and younger attending, And my daughter Ruth is now in her late 20s, and she and her band, The Mammals, that's Michael Miranda and Tao Rodriguez Seeger, they attend the camps, and they also have their own music career in kind of the same field that we're in, going. And, you know, so close to home, yes, and then we meet amazing youngsters out there every day who love to play some of these tunes and some of the ones we've written as well as the old traditional ones. It's very gratifying to be part of that big web.
It is, it is.
Well, Jay and Molly, it's good to know that traditional American music is in such good hands. We thank you so much for sharing some of it with us this hour.
Well, you're welcome. It's been wonderful to be with you today.
Great being with you, Gail.
Well, look forward to hearing more. And listeners, we're going to be closing this hour with Relax Your Mind. That's the title cut from their latest CD, which Jay and Molly perform with Swingology. To find out more about their new CD and when they might be coming to your town so that you can hear them in person, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
When you're driving in your automobile, keep your hands on that steering wheel. Sometimes, you got to relax your mind. Your mind. Relax your mind. Relax your mind. And you'll feel so fine sometimes. Sometimes. You got to relax your mind. Your mind. Turns green, you put your foot on the gasoline. Sometimes you got to relax your mind. Your mind. And when...
In just a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. But first, let's listen back to some of the sounds of this past week.
The enemy of peace has been Hamas, especially over the last 2 weeks. I don't think it's possible any longer to separate out into this piece, into various pieces. A commitment to terror and violence and a desire to destroy the state of Israel. I think this is a problem we have to deal with in its entirety, and that's the message we are taking to our friends around the world.
Colin Powell gave a testimony today that he is totally with the Israeli terror against Palestinian rights. He is an enemy to Palestinians.
There was an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade, attack on a U.S. military ambulance that was transporting a soldier who was injured in an unrelated incident. The result of this attack was one U.S. soldier was killed and two soldiers were wounded.
I actually have no doubt about the good faith of the Prime Minister and others who engaged in this exercise. I think it would be probably fair to say that there was a selection of evidence to support the conclusion rather than a conclusion that arose from a full consideration of the evidence.
Your support is laying the groundwork for a strong nationwide effort next year. Your support is going to help us achieve a strong nationwide victory.
In many respects, I'd like a chance to help this country. And I don't know if that means being president or doing something else. When you see the country in trouble, in challenge, yes, you'd like to pitch in and help.
What happened in Phoenix over the last several days has greatly affected us all. Jim Reed and his bereaved family are in our prayers, as are all the faithful of the Diocese of Phoenix.
We'll be proposing legislation that will protect the right of churches and religious organizations to sanctified marriage as they define it. At the same time, we will ensure that our legislation includes and legally recognizes the union of same-sex couples.
As you just heard, this week Colin Powell lays the blame for the recent violence in the Middle East squarely on Hamas. A Hamas leader injured in an Israeli attack says Powell's statement proves the U.S. is on Israel's side in that conflict. More violence in Iraq with a series of guerrilla-style attacks over the past 4 days that have left 3 more U.S. soldiers dead. And Britain's Tony Blair under fire over the inability to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. President Bush kicks off his re-election campaign, speaking at his first major fundraiser. Former NATO Commander General Wesley Clark opens the door to a possible presidential run. Embattled Phoenix Bishop Thomas O'Brien resigns after being arrested for leaving the scene of an accident that killed a pedestrian. And Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien announces that his country will become the third in the world to recognize same-sex marriages. Jack Beatty, as always, a busy week with some really haunting overtones for those of us who remember Vietnam all too well.
Oh, yes. Here we have Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz before the Senate this week. He said, quote, "There's a guerrilla war there, but we can win it." And another Pentagon source was quoted as saying, "We're fighting a counterinsurgency campaign in Iraq today." These have such echoes of Vietnam, don't they? Guerrilla war, counterinsurgency. Oof.
Yeah, and we've heard this before, haven't we?
Yes, we have. And the Washington Post today has some poignant quotations from soldiers. One, a sergeant near a station near Baghdad, he said, "What are we getting into here?" He's complaining that there are too few of them and that they're badly equipped for their job. He said, the sergeant said, "The war is supposed to be over, but every day we hear of another soldier getting killed. Is it worth it? Saddam isn't in power anymore. The locals want us to leave. Why are we still here?" And that question being asked by soldiers there, that's going to get back to their families, and it's going to get back to more and more Americans. Through that, I think people are going to be asking, why are they still there?
And that's certainly the kind of question that I'm sure President Bush doesn't want to hear as he's campaigning for re-election.
Not at all, not at all. But what a juggernaut that campaign is going to be. $200 million he's going to raise, perhaps more. He won't outspend the Democrat quite as badly as William McKinley outspent William Jennings Bryan. McKinley had $16 million to spend versus Bryan's $600,000. It won't be that bad, but it's going to be bad. And you have to say, you know, well, Bush looks like a, you know, the odds favor him. But, you know, I've been looking into that. The odds don't. Only 15 of our 43 presidents have served 2 terms. And of the 20 men who sought re-election since Jackson, 10 failed, were defeated. So that's 50-50. There's no 2-term tradition in American politics. It's much closer to a 1-term tradition. And when you look at the 20th century, the 4 who failed a re-election, Taft, Hoover, Carter, and Bush won. I mean, 2 of them for economic problems that won't be all that dissimilar from the ones facing George W. Bush.
Exactly. But we're all kind of assuming that the economy is going to be the big issue. I'm wondering, having heard what we just did, whether Iraq could be the big issue.
Well, it could be. And this is one of the things I think that's driving General Clark to consider running. He would have he was for containment of Saddam. He was not for this war, and he would be able to challenge the president on national security in a way that none of the other candidates would. And Bush will want to make the Iraq war salient in the election. And Clark, I think, is saying, well, if he does that, I may be the only person who can who can fight him on that ground.
So this could hinge on very different issues than what we're perhaps thinking of at this point.
It could indeed. And, something wonderful could happen in Iraq. A poll recently just published shows that people there strongly want the United States to stay, to make the democracy work, and everyone has to hope it will. The question is, how many young Americans are going to die to get that done? And how long is it going to take? And when can they leave? And these are questions that aren't going to go away, and they're going to come back to haunt Mr. Bush.
Well, I'm sure we're going to be revisiting them time after time over the next year or so. Thanks so much, Jack. Have a good weekend.
Thank you very much.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Chris O'Connor and Darren Mnuchin. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.